All right, we're going to get started. So we are in Genesis chapter 42. This is in the midst of the brothers coming down to Egypt. They have they've come down, and they're a little bit shook up when Joseph starts speaking harshly to them. He's testing them. We see in verse number 21 of Genesis 42 that the brothers are just racked with guilt. It's amazing that 13 years after they had sold their brother into Egypt that this incident comes up. Joseph, who they don't know is Joseph yet, speaks harshly to them, and the first thing they think is, God is judging us for what we did back then. So this indicates that they have been feeling the weight of their sin for a long time. Joseph weeps upon seeing his brothers. Of course, it would have been a painful reminder of everything. This is just a little bit of review here. We also see that Reuben, as he interacts with the brothers, and they're speaking in their native tongue, they don't realize that Joseph can understand them. Reuben's statement that his blood is required of us reminds the reader of Cain's murder of Abel in chapter 4, verses 10 and 11. And also God's command for capital punishment in chapter 9 and verse 6. So there's some repeated themes that show up in Genesis. They, as far as they were concerned, they had practically murdered their brother, even if they didn't actually plunge the knife in by selling him into slavery. They assumed that he was, in fact, dead. Yes, sir.
It's interesting. The reason why Joseph actually weeps there is because while they're talking amongst themselves about their guilt, he actually understands them because they're speaking in Hebrew. And because they figure he's using an interpreter, but he actually understands them, and that's the reason why he weeps.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some combinations there of painful reminders. Their admission to their guilt would have been enlightening. You know, for 13 years, he would have wondered, do they even think about me? Do they care? Do they, you know? And obviously, they do. Of course, Joseph, if you know the account, he tests the brothers. And
wouldn't it have been more like 19 years?
He's 17.
He's 30 when he...
You're right.
Then there's 5 years of plenty, and then there's probably a year that they go through the famine before they actually come, so you get 19.
You're right. That would be, in this spot, it would be longer. Yes, that would be true. All right, so Joseph's test is increased. He imprisons Simeon, sends the others home without their brother. And so that's where kind of we left off. And we then come to chapter 42, verses 27 through 38, and we have the brothers returning back to Jacob. Now, of course, you know the story right here that after Joseph approves their grain purchase, he keeps Simeon back. He instructs the servants to fill their sacks with grain, but also put money into their sack. And this, once it's discovered, terrifies the brothers. You know, they're on their way home. They need something to eat. So, hey, we're going to take some of the grain out of the sacks. And the first guy probably opens up, you know, whichever one was opening first and sees, my money's here. And then that's not good. And probably down the line they go and realize this is very problematic. The brothers are filled with fear, but so also is Jacob. It's interesting that Jacob shows little compassion for Simeon and selfishly wants to preserve his youngest son, Benjamin. You see this at the end of chapter 42. Verse 29, then they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, told him all that had happened. The man who was lord of the land spoke roughly to us. They describe all of this. And then they tell about, you know, verse 35, we open the sacks, the money is there. Verse 36, and Jacob their father said to them, "You have bereaved me. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And all you want to, and what you want to take Benjamin, all these things are against me. All these things are against me." And what is particularly striking there is, as far as Jacob is concerned, he just writes Simeon off at that point. He's gone. You know, he's not coming back. So very little care to actually think about actually going and getting Simeon. And thus, we can see here that the theme of fear drives the actions of the brothers and Jacob, both in chapter 42, but also we'll see in chapter 43 as well. However, in spite of some of the negativity that we see in Jacob, we also see that some of the brothers are truly becoming changed men. Reuben, in particular, here is a changed man. You read there at the end of chapter 42, he is willing to risk his own sons if it meant retrieving Simeon and returning Benjamin home safely. And that's an incredible change from a guy who was trying to assert dominance in the family not that long ago. Now he's willing even to risk his own sons. And so we do see aspects of redemption throughout this narrative. We see the ugliness of people's sin, but also we see the redeeming work of God in people's hearts and lives. Well, the brothers are going to go back to Egypt for a second time, and that brings us to chapter number 43. Chapter 43, the famine is continuing on. They have eaten up the grain that they have already received from Jacob or from Joseph, and they know the food's going to run out, and it surely did. Of course, they did not know that the famine was going to last 7 years. If you read all the way through the account, it isn't until Joseph and his brothers are reunited that Joseph informs them, "Hey guys, this is going to last for 7 years. This is a long time." So they don't know that at this point. You know, it's like, hey, we'll get through this year, we'll be fine, or get through this season, we'll be fine. And it wasn't fine. They, like the rest of that whole region, was in severe famine, and thus they're going to starve. And so that made it absolutely necessary for the brothers to go back to Egypt. Jacob is still operating out of fear in this chapter. He complains to his sons about their revealing that they had a younger brother. So you look at this, Jacob says, "Go back, buy us a little food." Verse 2, Judah speaks to him saying, "The man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You shall not see my face until your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we'll go down to buy food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said, you shall not see my face until your brother is with you.'" They recognize how powerful Joseph was. They're not going to go defy him in his own court. And Israel says in verse 6, this is a stunning statement. You still see aspects of Jacob's selfishness here. "Why did you deal so wrongfully with me as to tell the man whether you had still another brother?" I mean, what a really self-centered question at that point by Jacob. I mean, you know, as if the brothers were thinking, yeah, we really want to hurt Dad in this moment. I mean, they're standing in front of this man who is functionally, at that point, the most powerful man in the world. Technically, it was Pharaoh, but Pharaoh had given Joseph, you know, power over everything. So by function, he's likely one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful man in the world. They're not going to sit there and just defy him and lie to him. That's not it at all. So we see still the strife in the family. The healing has not yet come. So he complains. But he resigns himself to sending the brothers when Judah also guarantees his, that would be Benjamin's, safety. And in this text, we also see, and we'll see it even more, that Judah is shown to be a changed man. This is the guy that was very much willing to sell Joseph into slavery. And also, this is the guy who, slept with Tamar, who he thought was a prostitute. It turned out to be his daughter-in-law. These are pretty bad things. And yet, we see in him as well aspects of God's redeeming grace in his life. Jacob finally succumbs to this reality. One thing of note, and you just think about the text, as he offers a blessing upon his sons, down in verse 14, he uses the name God Almighty. So we do see that even Jacob realizes that he does need to trust God. And the reason that's important is that this name in Genesis is connected with the promise of descendants to the patriarchs. You can see the references there. And the significance of that would be that for Jacob, he is at this point realizing, in spite of what we just said about his negative side to him, he's realizing he needs to trust God, that God's going to take care of his sons. All right, that's I think, implied in that kind of statement. That's a guarantee of the descendants to the patriarchs. Now they come up with a plan. We're going to send all the money back. We're going to bring more money down. We're going to try to make this right. And they get back for their second trip to Egypt. And as you read through this account, the brothers are treated with kindness instead of harshness. So if you go back one chapter, you'll find that Joseph is really, he's rough with them. He speaks really tough with them. Here, it's just the opposite as well. You know, this is the account where he serves a huge feast for them. He brings out Simeon. Simeon's fine. It's clear that he's not been imprisoned roughly. You know, they sit down and they feast together. He also gives Benjamin a portion of five times greater than the rest. So there's a bunch of things there. But there is also, interestingly enough, Joseph weeps a second time as he watches all this. So he has all the brothers there in one room. He had not seen that since many, many years earlier. So he has all the brothers there, and he weeps again. And I think that indicates the hurt here was, in fact, deep. Part of the beauty of this narrative is not only seeing what God does in preserving his people, but also what God does in sanctifying his people. And both of those things are here. And you see some of this over time being healed. Joseph, as I mentioned, did bring out a portion five times greater for Benjamin. This is likely also a test to see whether the brothers would be jealous. Would they respond wrongly when that happened? The text shows they did not. In fact, they ate and drank and were merry, which means in the original language that they were drunk, probably to the point even of intoxication here. They drank according to the point of intoxication. So they're celebrating. They're having a great time. They can't believe it. And they've been blessed by this foreign dignitary. So after all of this, we get to chapter 44, and they are sent home. So he lets all the brothers go, doesn't keep any back. But you know the story. This is the one where he sends them home, puts all their monies back in the sack a second time, but he also places a specific special cup that Joseph had that is said to be used for divination. And so he puts that in there, sends his servant out. They find it in, of all places, surprise, in Benjamin's sack. And they're going to get hauled back in and brought before Joseph in a trial of sorts. And Judah is going to plead for Benjamin's life in really an amazing way. And then Joseph is finally going to reveal himself. So those are the events of chapter 44 and into chapter number 45. Just a couple of things to note about that count. I'm assuming that you guys know that at least basic storyline well. One is the question of the cup that is said to be used for divination. So if you go down at verse number 5, is not this one from which my Lord drinks, with which he indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing. So one of the questions that people ask as they come through this text is, was Joseph actually using that cup for divination? So the idea is you'd put a liquid, usually wine or some expensive drink in it, and you swirl the cup around, and supposedly the way things would lie in the cup and how it runs down the sides of the cup, you could tell the will of the gods at some level, right? So some sort of divination, or in various ways that you'd pour it out on things. So was Joseph actually practicing divination here? My answer is that no, he probably was not. This is his servant who's probably trying to intimidate these men and get them to fear. They would have expected a pagan guy to do this kind of thing. Divination is actually, through liquids, is explicitly forbidden in the Mosaic Code. You can see the references there. And so I don't think Moses would be highlighting that Joseph did this. I think the point was to scare them into thinking, oh, we're in big trouble. We've taken something that's really, really precious to Joseph. Now, is it possible that he actually practiced divination? Yes, we see at times, of course, many of the brothers doing terrible things. That's possible. But unlikely, given the fact that Joseph continually attributed all of his success, his ability to interpret dreams, to God. And we don't see any sort of divination experienced even when Joseph interprets the dreams. So that's just something that some people will wonder about coming through this text. Of course, the brothers, they can't believe that anybody would have stolen this particular cup. I mean, that would have been absolutely crazy, and I think that they would have thought that. They offer this deal. Anybody who is found with that cup, you know, you can execute him. You execute him right here, right? You kill him. That, we would have never done anything like that. Joseph's steward quickly changed that to only the one who stole the cup would be a slave. And, of course, Benjamin is discovered to have the cup in his sack. The brothers tear their clothes. This is the ultimate sign of mourning in this ancient Hebrew culture. They are filled with grief. They know exactly what this means for their father. And I do think that is an indication that God was working in their lives to bring healing in their family. That the brothers returned even with Benjamin, even though the steward had only said that Benjamin would be a slave, I think that indicates as well that they had changed. I mean, it would have been just as easy for them to just say, all right, Benjamin, we're going to go home to Dad and we're going to sort this out. But they come back. They are expressing solidarity. And Judah typifies this change with his expression of solidarity with Benjamin and all the brothers. He pleads passionately, as we see, for Benjamin. And that leads us there to number two, Judah pleading for Benjamin in chapter 44, verses 18 through 34. Judah's speech here is actually the longest speech recorded in the book of Genesis. So that's just interesting that Moses places a great deal of emphasis upon this. And in it, Judah demonstrates great compassion and signs of repentance. So you see this in a few ways. One is, let her see, he references his father 15 times in this. My father, my father, my father, my father. And you think about that, you know, before they didn't care what Dad thought. That's why they killed Joseph. They were angry about what Dad thought. He also uses honorable language to Joseph, calling him my Lord and identifying the brothers as his servants. Now, they don't know that's Joseph yet, but this is great humility. And most of all, he does not use this as an opportunity to leave his brother in Egypt. And it would have been easy to do that. They could have honestly gone back to Jacob, their dad, and said, we can't get him out. This is what the man said. This is what happened. He didn't steal it. You know, we can't get him out. So he could have done all of those things, but he could have left him, but he did not do that. Now, after all of this and this passionate plea, Joseph has clearly seen that his brothers have changed. And thus he reveals himself in chapter number 45. You know this account, right? He tells them all to leave the house. He begins weeping, and then he reveals himself, tells him God has a purpose in all of this. He greets Benjamin. Specifically first, and then all of the brothers, and they begin talking to him. That's the essence there of chapter 45, verses 1 through 15. So Joseph does ask everybody to leave the house. The text says that he wept so loud that the servants in Pharaoh's household heard it. Now that probably indicates that Joseph's house was right next door to Pharaoh's house, which makes sense. If you've got the number two guy in charge, you want to be able to meet with him regularly, and you don't need an hour commute across the city to make that happen. But even with that, the fact that he wept that loud would have been stunning to everyone. And this is the third time that Joseph has wept, third time that he's wept, which again shows just the severe anguish of all of this. The brothers, they are terrified. It's an interesting word in verse number 3. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Does my father still live?" His brothers could not answer for him, for they were dismayed in his presence. That's the way I think the ESV, New King James, translates it. But this is actually a very, very strong word. It's terror. They're shaken in their boots. And the shock of this revelation would have been nearly overwhelming. I mean, this is like the drama of this is why people are drawn to this account so much. It is hard to imagine what was going through the minds of these men at this point. I'm sure that they were very afraid that Joseph would bring his revenge upon them, which is why Joseph has to calm them three times. And in all three times, he notes that it was God who sent him. You see that in verses 5, 7, and 8. In fact, it's worth reading these. "But now, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting." By the way, Joe, that means 15 years. Right, if we do the right.
Well, he said at the end, you have 5 years left.
You're right. So seven.
The second time would have been 20 years, so it probably was a year before 19 the first time.
You're right. You're right. Because you had 7 years of plenty.
Right.
Before the...
So I was going five, so that'd be...
It's even longer.
It'd be 21 and then 22 for the second visit.
Yeah, I need to change that.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, so a long time for this. So for these 2 years, the famine has been in the land. There are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you. Here's his second time he mentions God. God sent me before you to preserve a posterity or a remnant for you in the earth. Verse 8, so it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he, God, has made me a father to Pharaoh, and so on. So we have here just an amazing statement, a series of statements by Joseph, who recognized that God was at work in his life. So verse 5 speaks of God's preserving life generally. Just life. God's the God of life. He spares life. And there would have been a tragedy if that famine would have been allowed to continue without somebody like Joseph and his wisdom. That would have decimated the population of that entire region. Verse 7 speaks of God preserving a remnant, which refers to the people of Israel specifically. Specifically. So God had a plan to care for all people. He also had a plan specifically for the people of Israel. And verse number 8 speaks of God's blessing of Joseph in spite of severe obstacles. He's made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of his house. Now I'm the ruler throughout all of Egypt. And there's just much to reflect on the providence of God and how God, for all those years, had been working to bring about this preservation of life, his plan for his people, his plan for the world. We also see even here another indication of the promise to Abraham that in him all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And we see that even with his grandson Joseph and being an instrument to bless not only the nation of Egypt, but also the surrounding nations around her. So that this is all part of God's plan. And you think about that in our day, we recognize how beautiful that is. But especially for the people of Israel as they're getting ready to cross into the promised land, they could look out throughout history and say, God has been working through us in amazing ways. Despite our sinful choices at times, God still works. Now, after Joseph finishes his speech, which is also dramatic as well, he and Benjamin wept together. You see this in verses 14 and 15. Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them, and after that his brothers talked with him. It's interesting that Joseph weeps over the rest of the brothers, but the brothers did not weep over him. It's just an interesting thing to note there. But after Joseph's weeping over them, they did then talk to him. And that's just fascinating too, right? This whole time they've been dumbfounded, silent. I mean, what are you going to say at this point? The utter shock of this. But I think there also is just a literary reference to the fact that this has brought around nearly full circle the disunion in the family to now unity again. So if you go all the way back in Genesis 37 and verse 4, you find there that they would not speak with him after Joseph gives his dreams. So we see that yet when they did speak with him, this is a reversal. There's your blank there under letter C, number 2. This is a reversal of how the whole account with the brothers began. So now they're actually talking. What a beautiful thing that is. Well, the story just gets better for the family. Pharaoh is going to invite Jacob to live in Egypt with his family. We see that chapter 43, verses 16 through 28. Pharaoh and his servants, they're pleased with the news of Joseph. Pharaoh offers this generous invitation. They could have the best part of the land. They could have the best food of the land. That's the idea of the fat of the land. They'd be given carts to transform their families. All right, you know, we're going to pay for, you know, we're not just going to give, you know, we're going to give you the U-Hauls. We're going to make sure that you can actually get down here, right? They were not to fret over bringing their goods. Pharaoh would provide for them what they needed. Now, they do bring their possessions, but Pharaoh's offer was, look, you just come now, and we'll make sure that you have everything that you need. Incredibly great blessing. Joseph executes what Pharaoh had commanded. He provided abundantly for their journey back to Canaan and to Egypt. It is interesting here, as he speaks to the brothers before they leave, down in verse number 24, that he tells them to not be troubled in their journey. Now, that's actually a difficult phrase to translate. It may mean that they should not fear, or it's even possibly fight about whether they should come back. Right? There's actually a debate about how to translate that, and you'll find different translations translated differently.
Yeah, my ESV says that not to quarrel on the way.
Yeah, ESV is quarrel. Yes. So just come. It'll be fine. Now, that may also indicate that Joseph is worried that they're not going to come back because, you know, they might be scared. but nonetheless, that's one of those that you'll see different translations there. It's just there's a bunch of linguistic things that are hard to know. It's not used very often in the Old Testament, and it has kind of a wide variety of meanings when it is used. If you pressed me on it, I would say it's probably fight or quarrel would be the best translation there. The shock for Jacob, of course, overwhelmed him. I mean, it says there that his heart stands still, you know? I mean, you know what that feeling's like. You get that news that just, you just feel like time slows down for a moment and you can't hear anything around you for a moment. Am I the only one that has these experiences occasionally, right? It's just like, this is, you know, you're just trying to process that, right? And that's what's happening here for Jacob. It overwhelmed him. But seeing is believing, at least in this case, he sees what is provided by Joseph, and Jacob believed the report. I mean, that's an unbelievable thing to hear. So, in fact, when I say unbelievable, it really is. All of us have had times in our lives when we've gotten news that have truly shocked us. But all of us probably can honestly say that the shocking news that we've received is not like new, like nobody else has ever had that happen to them before. It may have been shocking to us personally, but anything that I've had happen to me, whether good or bad, it's like I can relate that to someone else. Go, oh, other people have gone through similar things. Just don't know too many stories like this in the world, where a guy that you thought was dead is now literally, functionally, the most powerful man on the planet, and he's my son, right? So this is literally unbelievable news. It's just hard for us to fathom that, and it was for Jacob and the brothers too. Well, they decide to go, and but more than listening to what Joseph said, Jacob listened to what God says, and we see that in chapter 46, verses 1-7. Where God sends, Jacob. He sends Jacob to Egypt. Maybe he sent Jason too, I don't know. God sends Jacob to Egypt. And God reveals to Jacob that he should go to Egypt. This was in contrast to Abraham, who went to Egypt without God telling him to go, in chapter 12, verses 10-20. Remember that? He goes down to Egypt, and he goes there because there's also a famine in the land, but God didn't tell him to go. He just went. And that did not turn out well for Abraham. So in this case, you know, Jacob is like all of us, kind of a mixed bag. At times he shows just his sinful depravity. At other times he shows God's grace in his life. This is an example of God's grace. He says he probably heard the stories of his grandpa Abraham and him going down to Egypt, and says, I don't want to make that mistake again. And so he sacrifices to the Lord. He prays to God, and God reveals to him that he should go. Moses carefully records in verses 6 and 7 that all of Jacob's family and their households went to Egypt. That is not insignificant. So they took their livestock, their goods, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons' sons, his daughters, his sons' daughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. That's about as redundant as you can get. And Moses is doing that on purpose to emphasize the whole people went there, just like we're going to see if you keep going into Exodus, that the whole people leave. And so it's emphasizing both. God's preservation of his people. They were not a mixed multitude from the beginning. Jacob's family is given, we have a genealogy of him and his family in verses 8-27. I'll not read through all of those names. You can do that. All of the sons are mentioned with their sons as well, and the people that were coming with them. It is interesting that the introduction to this genealogy is the same as the opening of Exodus. These are the names of the children of Israel. These are the names of the children of Israel. Also in this account, Moses gives Rachel's children special attention as well, emphasizing again that Jacob had some sort of favoritism toward her. If you go all the way down to the end of this genealogy, the end of the chapter, towards the end of the chapter, I should say, it's recorded that 70 people enter into Egypt. That number is symbolic of wholeness for the people of Israel. Symbolic of wholeness for the people of Israel. And I think Moses intentionally does this. If you do a deep dive on this, you find that there are 66 people whose names are listed in this genealogy go down to Egypt, but by adding Joseph, his wife, and his two sons, that makes a total of 70 people It's probably where you get the number 70, and you can go count through that on your own time. I have done that many years ago because I read that in commentaries. I thought, oh, I should actually make sure this is true. And it is true. However, there are some other places that the list differs. Acts 7:14, that's where Stephen speaks right before he's about to be martyred. He speaks of 75 people. But this number includes, and I mentioned this probably, the children of Manasseh and Ephraim mentioned in 1 Chronicles 7:14 and following. So this is one of those areas where some people who are critics of the Bible will try to say there's errors. And I think that Moses is actually constructing this genealogy. I mean, all the names are accurate to emphasize the completion of the people there. Whereas 1 Chronicles 7:14 is giving a fuller genealogy, and that is the one that Stephen references in Acts chapter 7.
Question.
Yes.
To be.
To be or not to be? Do I have a blank there for you?
Yeah, two.
Anticipates the nation will grow in Egypt. Anticipation, the nation that will grow in Egypt. Does that help you? I didn't underline it in my notes, so then I don't remember that you have a blank there. And I didn't mention that at all. Yes, the use of that phrase is significant. It isn't used very often in Genesis. But again, Moses, he's not making things up. He's just emphasizing certain themes. This is the beginning of the nation of the children of Israel. Properly speaking, the children of Israel do not exist as a nation until God covenants with them in Exodus. Right? But Moses is saying that God was forming already that nation here early on. And let's see here. Let's see if we can power through the last of this real fast, all right? Joseph prepares his family to meet Pharaoh. You see this in chapter 46. And Joseph gives him a speech to meet Pharaoh. In essence, here's what you should do. Judah is the one leading the family. That reflects both Jacob's lack of trust for his eldest three sons, but also anticipates Judah's leading role that would grow and develop for the people of Israel. And here again, I have the wrong number, Joe. Thank you. Much longer than 13 years. It should be 20 some years after being apart. Joseph and Jacob reunite. Now, the reason this section is actually significant is not only just for the human interest of seeing father and son reunite. This is important. Number three, letter C. Joseph's instruction to Jacob and the brothers for how to meet Pharaoh seems to have a purpose of securing the land of Goshen as a dwelling place. This would allow Jacob and his family to remain distinct as a people. If you read through there, you might remember this. If you've read through there, or you've heard this preached taught before, that Joseph emphasizes that that the Egyptians think that sheep herders are an abomination. Remember, he says that several times. And that's hard to know whether they meant like all people who raise sheep, or it may be like nomadic people who raise sheep. It's really hard to know for sure there. But nonetheless, there was something that they didn't like. People have speculated as to why that is. One of the speculations is that they all lived around the Nile River, and they hated all the people who come and go and eat up all their beautiful green grass around the Nile River and, you know, their fields and stuff. So that's possible that. It's kind of like I grew up in Wisconsin, and in Wisconsin, everybody hates everybody from Illinois. That's just the rule. You do. And what you always say is those dumb flatlanders come up here with their rich money from Chicago and buy up all our land, and we don't like it. What's that?
It's their playground.
Yeah, Wisconsin was the Illinois playground, and that was just a thing. Now, truthfully, we liked them because they brought a lot of money. But the reality is it would irritate you. And so it might be something like that. But maybe even more, there was a cultural thing. By doing this, I think Joseph is trying to ensure that the people of Israel will remain intact as a people and not be fully assimilated into Egyptian life. So this whole thing is structured carefully to ensure that. By going to Goshen, where the flocks would be, and where they could hang out there, they will remain distinct as a people. And that's what happens. Pharaoh, in chapter 47, welcomes Joseph. You read through the account, Jacob and the brothers make it clear that they wish to dwell in the land as resident aliens. They didn't think of their status as permanent residents. Now they're going to stay there for about 400 years. They don't know that at this point. Jacob's blessing of Pharaoh in verse 10 is noteworthy. It implies a position of superiority, since normally the greater gives the blessing to the lesser. Gives the blessing to the lesser. Superiority. That is noteworthy in front of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh receives it. And also we see the blessing of God upon the people of Israel here, the descendants of Abraham and Isaac and now Jacob. If you read through chapter 47, 13 through 27, Moses there recounts how the people of Egypt, they basically have to sell everything and become wards of the state. Right? They all work for the government here in the end of chapter 47. All the citizens become civil servants working for the state, and they're happy to do so because they survive. But there is a contrast. You see this in verse number 27, right at the end of the chapter here. Why am I not seeing that right at the end of the chapter? Not quite at the end of the chapter. Thank you. Verse 27. So Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there and grew and multiplied exceedingly. So God blessed them even in a distinct way apart from the Egyptians. So the blessing of God was still upon the descendants of Abraham according to the promises of God. Those thematic elements become very important again for the people of Israel as they're getting ready to cross into the promised land. God had taken care of them all the way through. All right, I'm way over time, so I need to be done. Thank you so much. We'll get ready for the morning service.